Tokyo Podcast episode number 24.
On today's show, we're going to be talking to a Japanese filmmaker about his latest film called Happy and what he learned from the people of Okinawa that made his life a little bit happier. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, we're going to be talking to Japanese filmmaker Eiji Shimizu-san about his newest film called Happy. And this is a very interesting documentary about what it means for people and humans to be happy. Him and the director, a gentleman named Rocco Bellick, traveled around the world to interview different people about what makes them happy. And this whole documentary came about as a result of an article in the New York Times, which ranked countries according to happiness. Now, I'm not quite sure how they figured that out, if they just went to all the countries and, you know, counted how many people were smiling. But what was interesting is in this article, countries that ranked quite high were usually countries that weren't too well off economically. So they weren't very rich countries. For example, the highest ranking country was Bangladesh. Whereas some of the countries that ranked quite low were more richer countries like Japan and America. And as I believe that Japan actually ranks last in terms of happiness amongst all the industrialized countries. So this documentary is a very interesting look at what makes people happy and what we can learn from those people to make our own lives a little bit better off too. So I'm going to be talking to him a little bit later on in the show, but first, let's do the news. Joining me once again this week for our weekly episode of Japan Blog News is Sophie from Sophie's Japan Blog, bringing you all sorts of interesting links about Japan. Hey, Sophie, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you have for us this week?
We've got two interesting blogs this week. They're both pretty new as well, so they're still growing, and there's a lot of new content being put on them every week. The first one is nordiclotus.blogspot.com, and this is, I love this blog at the moment. I've never seen anything quite like it, actually. It's about Ikebana, which, if you've not heard of it before, is a traditional Japanese art of flower arrangement. It seemed to be almost as a new path of life and meditation. It's a very spiritual sort of art. The blog's founder, Nordic Lotus, is currently studying Ikebana at the Sogetsu School in Japan. And he's actually from Norway, which is very interesting in itself because I don't think I've ever read a blog from someone from Norway before. The blog's updated regularly with pictures of all the different forms of flower arrangement that he's been practicing in his class. And he explains the symbolism of each particular arrangement, which is very obviously things like the symbolism, the symmetry, the colours. Everything has a particular meaning, which is quite interesting. No two arrangements are the same, and the more unusual ones incorporate fruits such as pineapple. So if you're in Japan and if you are interested in learning more about Ikebana, there are two of these Sogetsu schools in Tokyo and Osaka, so they're worth checking out. Obviously, best thing to do is just go on the blog and look at all the different arrangements that the blogs use, because they're definitely very interesting to look at.
Yeah, I was looking through this, and it's kind of neat that I didn't know much about Ikebana before. One thing I found particularly interesting is that Ikebana often places emphasis on other areas of the plant besides the flower.
Yeah, like the stem and the roots.
Right, which is not something that we would normally look at. When you look at, say, a rose, you look at the flower, but you don't look at the leaves or even the lines that it forms relative to the other plants.
Yeah.
And Ikebana is all about the study of that form, the line, the shape. And it is kind of interesting that he uses like artichoke and vegetables and other forms
there's a lot of ones using fruits such as figs and pineapples, which almost looked like, I don't look almost like quite a fruit salad. I don't think obviously that was not what he was meant to be doing, but very colorful arrangements.
And the good thing is, if you use fruit, you can eat it after.
Yeah, it's always a good thing.
So yeah, if you're interested in finding out more about Ikebana, definitely check out this website. It's nordic-lotus.blogspot.com. What's the second one you have today?
The second website is kyushuvisitor.org. This is a website that provides tourists, international students and scholars with information on one of Japan's southern islands, Kyushu. It was founded as recently as November 2011 by a woman called Rinko Kawakami. She teaches scientific writing and presentation in Kyushu and aims to enhance Japan's image overseas and to revitalize the Fukuoka economies by encouraging international tourism. What's really great about the website is that it actually gives her students the opportunity to apply their writing skills outside the classroom. So it's not just benefiting the people who are interested in Japan, but also those who are already there. Obviously, for the majority of these students, English is not their first language, so it's very good practice for them to write an entire blog post in another language, talking about something that's obviously quite familiar to them because they're living in that area. This website's still growing at the moment, so there's currently not a huge amount of content on there yet, but it's sure to grow. There's a particularly great article on there about the Hoshino Tea Museum in Fukuoka. This is a museum where you can make your own gashi, which are traditional Japanese sweets, in a workshop. The history of the museum is very interesting as well. So this is one website worth subscribing to if you're interested in finding out more about Japan's cultural heritage.
Yeah, I think this website is interesting because the Kyushu area is a very, very beautiful area. And I actually used to live down in that area. I used to live in Oita. And
oh, wow.
So I think it's really good that this lady is trying to kind of promote tourism down to her particular area, because they kind of get overshadowed, I think, by, you know, the main tourist site, Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka, and all that.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that she's promoting, you know, her area and try to bring some more tourists down there.
Well, it's certainly somewhere I'd like to go next time I go to Japan.
Yeah, so if you're interested in checking out information about Kyushu or green tea or some of these really delicious looking sweets that she has on her website, visit kyushuvisitor.org. And if you're interested in more links and information about Japan, visit Sophie's website at sophiesjapanblog.wordpress.com. Thanks for joining us this week, Sophie.
Thank you very much. See you next week.
My guest today is Eiji Han Shimizu, who is the creator of the highly acclaimed manga series of biographic novels based on the lives of the Dalai Lama, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, and many other historic figures. He joins me today to talk about his latest film, Happy, and how the research for this film has profoundly changed his life. Hi, Eiji. How are you? Welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So I saw your speech at TED, where you talked about your latest film called Happy, and you mentioned that in the research for this film, it profoundly changed your life. Can you tell us what the film is about?
So 6 years ago, our executive producer, who is very successful comedy director of Hollywood, came up with this idea. He was reading a newspaper at a cafe in Beverly Hills where he used to live. And one of the articles on that newspaper said that the happiest country is Bangladesh. And of course, it's one of the poorest countries in the world. And then he started wondering because he has achieved his childhood dream and got to where he was in Hollywood, but the people don't seem very happy. They are living in a mansion, has very influential, their influence is very big. I mean, very influential person, and possibly they are the most beautiful people on earth, but none of them seem very happy. And at the same time, he was hiring a lot of, the people who take care of his house, gardeners, cook, and the drivers. And if he hanged out with all these people, they realized that these people who are not necessarily powerful, beautiful, or rich, sometimes have even bigger and more genuine smiles in their face. So if the money, power, and beauty don't make us happy, what does? Then he came up to my best friend, Rocco Balich, who is the director of this film, to document what's going on with happiness. And he asked me to join the project as a producer. And 6 years ago, we embarked on this journey to find out what makes people genuinely happy.
What did you think of the idea when you were first approached about it? How are you going to research this? Were you going to just go talk to people and say, are you happy? Are you not happy? Like, how do you find this stuff out?
Okay, good. So we've done quite a bit. As you said, the happiness is very broad concept.
Right.
If I were to make a film about coffee, it's relatively easy. I just talk to Starbucks employees and then coffee experts and coffee lovers, and then the documentary is right there. But when it comes to happiness, there are different definitions of happiness to each person on Earth. So first, we did intensive studies on happiness, reading all the documents, so lots of documentaries about happiness and well-being. And then we got some idea what's going on, in the field of psychology, neuroscience, philosophy, anthropology, and spirituality. Then we started interviewing experts in these leaders in neuroscience, psychology, philosophy, anthropology, and spiritualities. And what's amazing was that the although these comments and experts are coming from different fields, many of them are saying the same thing. We thought that we will get a whole different kinds of ideas and theories, but after talking to them, some basic themes came out as universally effective happiness-enhancing methods. So once we got that, then we started traveling around the world. We went to 14 different countries to document different lives and different takes on happiness. And we visited places like Kalahari Desert to hang out with Sam Bushman, the slum dwellers in Kolkata, India, hanging out with single mothers in Denmark, surfers in Brazil, porn star in LA, and also the salaryman from Shinbashi, Tokyo. So applying what we have learned from the experts and see how these theories are working in the lay people like us.
What did you find was one of the most common emotion that makes people happy?
Actually, that's a good question. So we went around and documented all the happy, unhappy, so-so happy lives. And then we ended up having like 400 hours of tapes. That's a lot of tapes. And then we managed to shrink it down to 78 minutes of a documentary, feature-length documentary film. And whenever I tell this story, lots of friends of mine who have a very short attention span said, no, I don't have time for 78 minutes. Give me one quick answer. Then I think about, okay, what to say. And then actually, I sum it up with one short sentence, which is, After traveling around the world and documenting happiness for 6 years, I couldn't help but noticing that there aren't selfish, happy people.
Interesting.
What I mean by that is that the happy people that we saw in this pursuit of happiness are very kind, compassionate, altruistic, and giving. Whereas, you know, I think about the three most miserable person that I know, I would say they are self-centered, egoistic, and, you know, the pursuing their own happiness only. And, Anthony, I have a question. I mean, if you do the same thing for three happiest people you know, and then think about their commonalities, you know, I'm sure it's, you know, difference can be the nationality, gender, income level, ethnicity, and so forth. But I would bet you that these three happiest people you know may be also compassionate, giving, altruistic.
You know, when you mentioned that in your video, I kind of thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting is that the happiest people that I know, they vary quite a bit in economics, from people who are just kind of struggling to some of my friends who are worth, you know, $50-60 million.
Mm-hmm.
And what I actually kind of noticed amongst them all was that they all have a sense of, how do I say this? They all have a sense of detachment to their possessions and their life. Mm-hmm. They don't really have any kind of, like, it's just that they didn't really care the material goods in their life, whether they had it or not. And so they seemed really content mm-hmm. with their place in life. Almost kind of like a Buddhist sense of right. detachment to their material surroundings, whether they had a lot or they had a little.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually noticed that a long right. time ago when I used to be in business, and I noticed I had a lot of really wealthy clients. And I noticed that the ones who were really concerned about their stuff, their boats, their cars, their homes, and all that, they were the ones that were the most stressed. And then the other ones who had the same types of cars, Bentleys, Ferraris, and big houses and all that, but they didn't really care if they had it or not. They could be comfortable in a big house or a small house. They were the ones who seemed to be the most happy.
Yeah, very interesting. Actually, that happens to me as well. My father, about a year ago, bought quite a nice car. You know, in Yokohama where he lives, and he really wanted to have this car, and once he finally had it, all the concerns and worries start happening. You know, what if somebody scratches? You know, what if he can't find a right parking spot for this big car? And then, at the same time, about a little over a year ago, I moved to Bali, a small town called Ubud in the north. And my life is so simplified. I own, I don't know, like 10 t-shirts, five, you know, the socks and then, you know, two shorts and, you know, very simple life. And then I don't worry about my position anymore. My life is so simple that, you know, all the worries and the concerns are also simplified in that way. And I feel happier here.
I can understand. Because I used to live in Thailand. And I mean, in Thailand, the same thing. You have five t-shirts and two, three pairs of shorts and a couple flip-flops, and that's about it. But I remember once when I was in Thailand, I was talking to this woman who worked as a cleaning lady. And she didn't make very much money. But she was making more money at the time than she ever had in her life. You know, it wasn't very much. It was only like $200 or $300 a month, but it was more than she had ever made. She was from northern part of Thailand, farm country, came to the city to work. And she said something very interesting to me. She said that Before she had money, she never worried about money. You know, she said that when she lived on her farm, she never worried about it. But now she has money, she realizes how little money she actually has. And I thought that was very interesting because here she is making more money than she's ever had in her life. And yet, instead of that money giving her a sense of security or accomplishment, it actually gave her a sense of lack, of lacking something in her life, but that she never had before. Before the money, she never had that feeling of lack. And I think that's quite common for many people in at all levels of the economic scale, from a farm girl in Thailand to, you know, a Hollywood person in LA, is that the more you have, if you focus on, it's easy to kind of focus on what you don't have. You know, you get a car, but then your neighbor gets a nicer car. You get a house, but then someone else has a bigger house. And that's where I think a lot of unhappiness comes in.
Yeah. In our film, we talk about that. As I mentioned earlier, you know, some people who are giving and altruistic and compassionate tend to be happier. Some psychologists analyze the fact that by giving, maybe they are realizing how much they have to give instead of about how little they have. So this switch of perception will make them feel that will make them to see the glass half full, as opposed to the glass half empty. Yeah.
Right. Because if you're giving away, you're focusing on the abundance that you have.
Right.
No matter how big it is or how small it is.
Yeah. And in that.
But if you're not sharing, if you're not giving it away, then you're focusing on lack and what you don't have.
Right. Exactly. And then the act of giving is a power. You make this act proactively, as opposed to just wait for the money to come in. You know, no matter how little it is, you actually make a decision to act upon it. So that's a power, I think, and that gives a sense of a control to many. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that in that article it said that Bangladesh was the happiest country in the world. And Bangladesh is obviously not a very strong economic country. But Japan, in that same article, ranked 90th.
Mm-hmm.
And Japan is obviously a much more economically strong country than Bangladesh. But the ranking was quite low, quite a bit lower than America even. Yeah. What do you think attributes Japan's such a low ranking on that happiness scale?
Right. First of all, there are lots of studies ranking you know, the countries in order of happiness. So this particular study lists Bangladesh as the happiest, but some, you know, studies show that the Denmark is the happiest, and, you know, the Bhutan and so forth. So having said that, Japan, on the all these different statistics, Japan is least happy countries among the wealthy industrialized nation, which is sad. And I think in our film we cover unhappiness in Japan, and you know, we focus the aspect of corporate centric society. It is good, and it's our virtue that, you know, we Japanese tend to work harder than other, you know, nationalities maybe, and that's what made us who we are in the world after the war. And I'm not arguing that, but it seems like this our characteristic, our virtual characteristics have been, let's say, like hijacked or exploited by corporations.
I agree.
Now, if you just randomly select one family in Tokyo, you will see that the role of the father is missing, because the time that the fathers were supposed to spend with their families are replaced by, occupied by corporations. So the kids grow up without, you know, absorbing the important and an essential nutrients from fathers. So the family cannot sustain themselves. Or I would say that it's very difficult to have a well-functioning family with the proper existence of fathers in busy Tokyo life.
Do you think part of it is the Japanese culture? I noticed that in Japanese culture, they seem to respect the ganbaro, you know, the trying of something, the effort of something, the struggle of something.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that kind of plays a role in the kind of low ranking of Japan in these happiness scales? The fact that they're always focusing on the struggle?
I think it's a national trait, and I think it's a good thing. You know, we all ganbaru. Ganbaru spirit is
right.
Very important, and I think that should be here to stay. But my point is that this ganbaru spirit is being exploited by corporations. Japanese historically been doing this ganbaru could be for community. Could be for the self-enhancement, could be for family, but now it seems like all the ganbaros are used up for the material advancement or higher stock price. So I think we should maintain this ganbaro spirit, but balance it out with some other important things such as community, self-enhancement, and friends and family.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you there. One thing that's interesting is you found that the people in Okinawa are some of the longest living Japanese people in Japan, and they're also the happiest people in Japan. Do you think there was a correlation between people who live the longest and people who are the happiest?
Yes. Actually, first, talked to a bunch of scientists, and they repeatedly said that the happier people are healthier, and they even live longer. Then we came up with this hypothesis: hey, maybe if we go to some community where a bunch of centenarians, then we may indeed find happy community. So we looked around, and the research is what's going on with the longevity, and then Okinawa, and actually this like a certain community called Ogimison in Okinawa always ranked on the top of the longevity. So we did go, and then sure enough, first we thought that we're gonna just simply meet a bunch of happy people, but the community was indeed a happy, very happy place, and all the grandmas and grandpas are oozing out with happiness. So it was quite surprising that in addition to Okinawa, we did cover Tokyo and show unhappiness of Japanese lives, but juxtaposing that unhappiness with Okinawa happiness, we could see what the entire Japan can potentially become. So I'm saying that Tokyo is an unhappy place, or Okinawa is a happy place. What I wanted to point out is that we should, everywhere in Japan, we will find so-called maybe Okinawa-ness. And then even in Okinawa, we will find Tokyo-ness. And it's important to spread what we are capable of becoming. Okinawan grandpas and grandmas are, you know, doing. And that sense of community, connectedness among people, and, you know, this, you know, some spirituality that we Japanese used to have everywhere. And I think it's important to reevaluate, you know, some of Okinawan-ness in other part of Tokyo, other part of Japan.
What lessons did you get from the people of Okinawa that perhaps other people in Japan could use?
Okay, I think their lives are slower. They are, I mean, they put a different priority in their life. Their lives are a lot slower. They would spend more time, resource, and focus on community, friends, family. Whereas, let's say in Tokyo, we tend to focus more on the you know, economic development. And actually, I often jokingly use this analogy. Imagine, Anthony, that you really wanted to go to toilet. You want to go pee.
Okay.
Right? And right at this moment, I will give you the best quality chocolate in front of you. Or I will serve you the most expensive red wine. Or maybe like, a, you know, I don't know, the most beautiful girl, you know, sitting next to you. You have all the opportunity to enjoy the best of the world. But at this point, if you wanted to go to pee, you cannot enjoy none of that.
Right.
You do not have, right. So the effort shouldn't be poured into increasing this already the best quality chocolate. Instead, we should go to toilet and pee.
Right.
To me, it seems like, you know, in Tokyo, everybody is like struggling to get the best of the best. You know, I don't know, the shark fin soup, or, you know, this Matsuzaka beef, or, you know, a Gucci bag or whatever. But they're trying and trying to get the best of the best. But I wanted to ask them, hey, maybe you gotta go pee so that you can enjoy mediocre level of chocolate or whatever. So having said that, in Okinawa, they have, their lives are slower, and they are more grounded, so that the chocolate or wine that they have are not necessarily the top quality, but they have mind and capacity to fully enjoy the quality of these things. So that's my pee analogy.
That's your pee analogy. That's your solution to the unhappiness in Japan, eh? Just go oshiko. But I think you're right, though. I think is that when you can eliminate some of the stresses in your life, it allows you time to focus on what you have, and you can appreciate things more. It's all really just, yeah, you know, it's common knowledge, but it's all just depends on how you look at things. You could have a right, mediocre bottle of wine, and you could look at it and go, ah, this isn't the best. Or you could say, hey, I can enjoy this bottle of wine. It's really just focus and perception, and the ability to control, you know, how you think.
So in our film, we are focusing on that aspect. How can we attain the mentality and mind that fully enjoy this mediocre stuff?
Right.
You know, it's about perception, you know, the day-to-day activities. We are, you know, introducing a variety of techniques and a way of thinking to facilitate that process.
Right, right. And I'm curious that you mentioned in your TED talk that this film profoundly affected your life. Can you talk about that?
Okay. So the Rocco, the director of the film, and I have traveled around the world and document happiness. And then indeed, we found some of the amazingly happy people. You know, unhappy people, so happy people. But we noticed that there are certain way of thinking and techniques that the happy people employ. And I, not as a filmmaker, but as a person, I really wanted to improve my happiness. So after the shooting was done, Rocco was in the editing room, editing, and I gave myself some time to explore the world to enhance my own happiness. So, for instance, I was in the Himalayas for 3 months meditating. Some said that doing the volunteer work is very good, so I did a bunch of volunteer works. Some said that certain like a breathing technique is good, so I did it. Certain yoga was good, I did it. Positive psychology is has a lot of intervention techniques, so I got certified in positive psychology. So I did whatever available in terms of enhancing happiness level. And one of the things that I did also was to simplify my life. And I chose to move to Bali to have a much simpler life. And then indeed it's working, I'm a happier person. So I meditate a lot. I practice things that are proven to be effective according to positive psychology, and I simplified my life, and I'm happier here.
What do you say to people who would hear that and say, well, I don't want to simplify my life too much. I like my cars and my house and my TVs and all that. I don't want to live in a hut on the beach somewhere. How can I be happy with my current lifestyle?
Definitely it is possible to have a happy life with all the great tools and material possessions. And but I think it is important to be able to be mindful in our daily lives. Mindful, what I mean by mindful is that you will know where your mind should be at. For instance, if you wake up and automatically you start worried about, okay, so I have 7:30 meeting. In order to go to office at 7:30, I have to take my notice in by 6:52. And then I have to finish the breakfast. And then do I have the PowerPoint ready? Oh, the PowerPoint was not ready. And then, then I get that my boss is going to be upset. So your mind, tend to, shift, your memory shift to, one emotion, and the emotion, got transferred to, another physiological reaction, and then it brings to another thought, and then mind tend to get go all over the place, right. And then that's a necessary state of mind in order for a business person to function well in a society. But sometimes you need to bring the all kind of like a monkey mind back to your center. Otherwise, your mind goes everywhere. And to me, living in a simple life always bring me back to this this calibrated locations where mind should be, instead of my emotions controlling my mind. I wanted to control my emotions. I mean, my mind should be controlling my emotions. And that's what I mean by mindfulness. And there are certain techniques to regain mindfulness, and meditation will be very effective tools Yeah, that's one of the things that I highly recommend for somebody who still enjoy Tokyo lives, but wanted to create a peace in their busy lives.
Yeah, I agree. I think that one of the hardest things that people can do, and probably one of the things that causes the most unhappiness, is the ability to control your mind and control and focus what you control what you focus on. Because no matter what your situation is, and especially if it's out of your control, and that's where most of the time where we get unhappy, right? Where when our situation gets out of our control, the one area where you do always have control is what you choose to focus on. And I think some of the happier people in your film are the ones who just seem to always focus on the positive, no matter what.
Right.
And I think even if you're living, it doesn't matter what kind of life you're living. You can live in busy Tokyo life. You can live in Okinawa. You can live in Bali. You can live wherever, no matter what lifestyle you have. Because I've seen people who are really rich and are really unhappy. And I've also seen people who are really rich and are very happy. So I just think it's a matter of controlling your focus. And I know I try myself, but I think that's one of the hardest things that human beings can do.
Right. But with the practice, I mean, it's so possible. I was one of those people who cannot focus. I mean, my mind is always drifting away. And then, you know, it was hard to stay focused. But with little practice, it is possible to control your mind.
Yeah, I agree. And I think meditation does help a lot, too.
Right, right. I mean, sadly, meditation has a bad name in Japan. Like yoga. Yoga is now popular. You know, it's great for health and beauty. But some, you know, the Om Shinrikyo or some religious sects abused, you know, the yoga and meditation. So whenever I talk about, I'm not religious at all. But I fully get benefit from the from meditation. And whenever I talk about meditation to some of my Japanese friends, you know, their reaction goes, "Oh my God, you know, Eiji is onto something weird." So I think it's very important that to realize that you know, we Japanese have a very beautiful Zen culture. Meditative Zen culture, yeah. And then it's important to learn something from the past. And actually, Zen, you know, the meditations, they have a lot of benefits that today's Japanese can enjoy.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's ironic, too, that many people that will use these study habits or practice meditation to further their career, you know, to see how I can use this to make more money, which in itself is not terrible. But I agree that I think that meditation or any kind of exercise that calms your mind down is always beneficial. When I lived in Thailand, I had the privilege of speaking to a foreign monk. He was a Gaijin monk who lived there, an incredibly smart man. Mm-hmm. And I said to him too, I said, you know, I've tried meditation and I've tried to sit there quietly and my mind doesn't calm down. I keep thinking of all these other things. And then he said, well, if I can't control my mind, then who's going to do that for me? You know, if I'm upset that my life is out of control, and I can't even control my own thoughts, mm-hmm. then whose fault is that?
Right.
So I think really the first step on the path to kind of this new life and a freer, more content, happy life is to start controlling the one thing that you absolutely do have control over, and that is your mind and your thought process.
Right. And it is possible. That's one of the strong messages from our film. It is possible to control your mind.
Well, if people want to check out your film, where can they find it?
Okay, so two things. In Japan, we are starting our theatrical distribution from the middle of May. And you can go to theaters like Uplink in Shibuya. And you can see the film in theaters. And also, if you have an iTunes account, and you're also from Canada or the US, you can download Happy onto your computer. And currently, Happy is the number one documentary on iTunes.
Oh, that's great. And people can also check out the website at thehappymovie.com. And if people are interested in reading some of your biographic manga novels, they can check that out at biographicnovel.com as well. Thanks, Aiji. Thanks for coming on the show today and telling us about your film. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Thank you, Anthony.
Thanks again to AG for coming on the show. If you are interested in checking out his movie, visit their website at thehappymovie.com, or you can download the film on iTunes if you have an iTunes account, and it is currently the number one most downloaded documentary on iTunes and is getting a lot of positive comments. So if you're interested in checking that out, visit your iTunes store. If you are interested in the Buddhism series that I briefly talked about, when I was in Thailand, I hosted a podcast called Bangkok Podcast, and on that show, we had a British-born monk who had been an ordained monk in Thailand for many years, and he came on the show to talk about how Buddhism plays a role in people's lives in Thailand, and how those of us who maybe aren't practicing Buddhists can use the principles and the thinking in Buddhism to improve our own lives. So it was a very interesting series. It was extremely popular. We covered all sorts of wide range of subjects, such as religion versus science. We talked about how your belief system and what you believe affects your life. And, you know, and Pandit, the monk's name was Pandit, and he would ask us all sorts of strange questions like, do you believe what you believe? And how do you know if your beliefs are correct? And I mean, these would be real head scratchers for us. But he also covered a lot of other areas. I remember when the earthquake struck in Japan last year, we asked Pandit, how does Buddhism teach us to deal with tragedy? And how do we overcome these kinds of unexplainables that we have to deal with in life every day? So if you're interested in checking that out, visit my website at bangkokpodcast.com/category/Buddhism, and you will see all the shows that we recorded with Pandit. And also, I will post a link to that site from my own website at tokyopodcast.com. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.